Okay, so I think we're ready. Are there any announcements? Is there anything going on? Do people have any workshops or activities that you've been involved with you'd like to let everybody know about?
Hi, Peg Steffen. We just had an open solicitation for people to join our Climate Stewards Network. And we had 220 people apply. We're going to offer the opportunity to about 80 folks. So I think it indicates that there's a very high interest and need out there among formal and informal educators. So we're really excited about the number.
And so, and what are these people going to
well,
do?
Well, they'll be able to kind of join the group. We have a very active wiki. We have monthly meetings, and then they will also be eligible for some mini-grant money to do stewardship projects and for some travel stipends to go to workshops in their area. Or this spring we'll be sending a few people to NSTA in Indianapolis.
Mm. Are these people from have particular backgrounds that you're looking for, or is it a range of expertise?
You know, we've been getting quite a range of people. We've got everything from kindergarten teachers to college professors, and we also have gotten quite a few people who are nature educators, fish and wildlife, refuge outreach folks, people from the Forest Service. So we've really gotten quite a wide range of people who are interested, and I think because we provide a lot of webinars like what we're going to hear today, they're very interested in joining, and our webinars are always later in the evenings because that's when most of our K-12.
I see. Well, that's great. So the wiki that they're going to be creating, is that something that others can see the contents of?
Well, right now it's a private wiki, so not right now, but we're hoping to get a website up and running soon. So there would be some common things that anybody could see. And I want to tell you, Tamara, that I'm hoping that a few people who apply to be climate stewards, we just don't have room for them all, we would like for them to be able to join this climate literacy group because they would be more appropriate to be part of this group as opposed to the group that we have.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, you can point them to, I think that they can click on a link to join, or if it's appropriate, you can ask, maybe just provide us with the list of email addresses if people agree. I understand that there might be issues about doing that, but whatever is appropriate would be great.
Okay. All right. We will send them your way.
Hey, Peg.
Okay.
Peg, this is Chris from Hogle Zoo, and I just want to say that it's been a really great program to be part of this Climate Stewards program this past year. So,
good. Yeah, I'm glad. You're one of our active folks, and we're really happy to have you in the group. Thanks.
And who was that was just talking?
Chris Schmitz from Hogle Zoo.
I see. Okay, are there any other announcements? Okay, great. Well, if not, then we will move on to our presentation for today. Today's presentation is the Climate Literacy Zoo Education Network, CLIZEN. It's going to be presented by Alejandro Grajal, who is Senior Vice President for Conservation and Education at the Chicago Zoological Society. And he is the PI for this network of zoos and I think Aquaria also, that is a CSEP Phase 1 project. And so, Alejandro, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. And I tried to race through the program because at previous seminars I found, at previous of these meetings, I found that there's very little time for questioning. So I tried to race, but if you feel that anybody has a question or wants to interrupt at any given time, let me know. And I also understand this is an hour, so I'm going to try to finish a little before one, isn't it?
Okay, great.
Okay. So first, on slide number two, I'm going to make a few introductions. That's me there. And my co-PIs are Michael Mann, the director of Penn State University Earth System Science Center, and fairly well known among our circles with his defense of the hockey stick graph. And then Susan Goldman, who's the co-director of the Learning Sciences Research Institute at the University of Illinois here in Chicago. That has been a very fruitful partnership that we've had, not only on this project, but several other ones, in an interdisciplinary team on learning sciences. Then on slide number three, I also list the original participant institutions. There are nine zoos mentioned here. There's Polar Bears International, the Penn State, University of Illinois at Chicago, and an informal conservation psychology network that has existed for a few years and we've supported in the past. On slide number four, I also plotted the existing zoo partners because even after the original NSF application, we had a few zoos that came to us to do the national survey that we'll mention in a little while. And then in the blue dots, you have the aquariums that also joined us. And I just wanted to remind everybody that there's also a CCEP1 partnership with the aquariums. And they agreed to be part of this national survey, which would inform not only our decisions, but their decisions. On slide number five, I present the main goal of this Climate Literacy Zoo Education Network, and is to inspire people to make personal connections to climate change by creating a sense of caring and concern for animals whose very existence is threatened by climate change. And the pivotal words probably in this one is personal connections and caring and concern. So I'll explain that through the presentation, but that was a major overarching theme around our original planning grant. On slide number six, I present a little bit of a preamble of how this partnership came about with three main premises. One of them is that efforts to educate people about climate change have realized relatively limited success, that this has mostly relayed on experts putting information to the public via media of all sorts, and the fact that there is a strong scientific consensus about climate change. Yet, the proportion of Americans who believe that the evidence supports climate change has changed relatively little, and there's a number of surveys that are showing that there isn't a huge change in the American public about climate change. The question for that why is we probably think that climate change education has not taken into consideration the way people learn and change their behavior, and the fact that the approaches have been relatively content-driven as opposed to learner-driven. In slide number seven, I mentioned how we planned originally to move in this realm. One of them is that we wanted to develop a new approach to climate change education, in which we will explore the associative and affective pathways known to dominate decision making in the general public. And the second one that is different from common approaches to climate change education is that these approaches have been largely didactic in nature. That is, experts rely on information, but not taking into account those associative and affective pathways that really affect decision-making. So for the planning phase, we set out to have three major general goals for the project. One of them was to research the preconceptions, attitudes, beliefs, and learning modes of zoo visitors regarding climate change. And that was the context of our national survey, which I will mention in a little while. The second one was to prototype innovative learning environments and tools to see how close we can get to those learning modes. And the third one, whether we could actually develop a viable partnership. You may remember that the original request from NSF, whether these partnerships were viable. So that was the next step for us. On slide number 8, and again, anybody wanting to interrupt, just let me know. We've based our project on these three premises. One of them was that affective connections really drive behavioral decisions. That presenting scientific evidence has relatively limited effect in learning modes of zoo visitors. And the third one is that zoos have a unique opportunity to establish those personal connections to animals threatened by climate change. Of course, the natural candidate in this case are polar animals such as penguins and polar bears, but we can narrate the story in the context of many different creatures that are affected by climate change. In slide number 9, I'll just go, I stated the mission as it's written, but the vision of the project was to develop a network of U.S. zoos in partnership with climate change scientists, learning scientists, conservation psychologists, and stakeholders to develop a sustainable infrastructure to investigate strategies to foster changes in climate change. So we embarked on that under the assumptions in slide number 10, two core assumptions. One was that behavior change can be fostered through understanding of empathetic responses to the impacts, causes, and strategies for animal species that are affected by climate change. And the second is that the resources of U.S. zoos, which host over 120 million visitors a year, can have a significant impact on fostering the understanding of climate change. So one of the core assumptions was that we can understand the response to climate change through those empathetic connections to animals, and the second one, that U.S. zoos are really good platforms for delivering that conceptual framework. So that was kind of the framework for the project. And what I'll do now on the following slides is to mention where we are in the project, some of the early deliverables, and then I'll finish on what the working hypotheses are for us for the next phase of the project, for this implementation phase that we're aiming with a proposal to NSF. So in slide number 11, I have the four major deliverables that we promised to NSF. One of them was to do a literature review, and every project had to do that. The second was to prototype some of these interventions, and I'll mention two of them, youth interpreters and a video game. The third one was the audience survey that we did regarding climate change at zoos and aquariums. And the fourth one is an evaluation of whether the partnership is viable. I won't dwell on the fourth one because our evaluators are coming out with their report, but just to say quickly that the partnership is viable in the fact that we've been able to keep it together, working together, and the stakeholders remain very, very involved in it. In slide number 12, I mentioned the results of our literature review, and it was fascinating because in early 2011, we hosted all the experts on the field and realized that there were a number of interdisciplinary bridges that we crossed that were unknown to most other people. So, for example, our climate change experts, the geophysicists, were fascinating by the research that has been done on, say, virtual social media or psychology. The psychologists were very interested in knowing what the ecology of polar bears and polar animals was. So we ended up saying, well, this is no way of going about, you know, dumping references and not distilling into a cohesive and relatively succinct way of presenting all this information. So we decided to do a general a book that would be of general interest to zoo and aquarium educators, but basically to almost anybody with interest in climate change education in the informal or even formal sector. And I just list here the table of contents. I'll go very quickly through it, but basically a general review of the state of the art in climate change, general review of polar animals, the roles of formal and informal education, psychological barriers, zoo messaging, how technology changes behavior, the role of online social information networks, and kind of a review of zoo and aquarium experiences on that.
Alejandro, this is Tamara. Is this ebook available for anybody who might be interested in looking at it now?
We are in the final stages of design. We're hoping to launch it in early April, and we will put out all kinds of media messages, so you'll hear it when it's out. And
okay,
we're publishing
great.
So it on three platforms. We're publishing it as a PDF, which will be downloadable, but also as a as an iPad and Kindle platforms.
Okay, great. Because we can send out the email through the Climate Literacy Network.
Yes.
Also.
Yes, that would really help. So, yes, we'll keep everybody abreast of that. The book is pretty much written, but it's in the design phase right now. The next deliverable was to develop an electronic tool, and this was the result of many and long discussions. In the end, we concluded that we were going to develop a video game, which preliminarily we're calling out Mile in My Paws. I put a YouTube link, but don't bother opening it right now because it's not that exciting. You will see somebody trying to move his her arms in front of a TV screen, which was a video of the video game. But basically what we're doing is that we're using movement and pressure sensors in which zoo visitors then participate in a virtual game in which simulates a polar bear trying to walk and swim between ice floes to reach a destination and capture a seal. So somebody sits in front of a screen that is a sea ice landscape, and they can run on the ice, basically simulating running on a touchpad, and then they use gloves that have accelerometers that that simulate swimming. And we ask people to choose a year in which they want to do this game. And of course, in the early part of and we have from 1950 to 2050. So in 1950, a polar bear could easily run over the ice and capture the seal. But in future years, it will have to do most of its swimming. And we actually built in into the video game that swimming is a lot less effective than running. So it is an interactive, participatory, embodied simulation activity, but the main objective of this video game was how could we explore the public conceptions of change over large temporal and spatial scales. So how can we accommodate decades of ice, sea ice density, and how can we accumulate miles of sea ice distribution in a video game that can last a couple minutes and in which people can actually embody the effects of sea ice melting much earlier in the late part of the 21st century. So the prototype will be deployed here at Brookfield Zoo in the early summer, and we're hoping to get feedback from users. Once we get that feedback, we may refine that video game into a more robust platform and maybe move it to a commercial platform such as a Nintendo Wii or a PlayStation or something like that. But at this moment, it's just a prototype to be tested at the exhibit. The next activity that we piloted during this phase was youth interpreters. And we used a collaboration with Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle. And for this one, we got external funding from Boeing Corporation, in which we asked youth interpreters to engaged in an inquiry project that they were doing about bears selecting microhabitats in a zoo exhibit. And the discussion about whether bears select one environment versus the other within the zoo habitat was basically the trigger for a discussion about climate change consequences and for these bears. Very succinctly, I'm just going to go over some of the major results. Here, we didn't find any significant changes in climate literacy in our audiences. And we believe that this is due to large variability, and I'll mention that a little more later about design issues with measuring climate literacy in large audiences and the effect of variability on those samples. The second one was that we found significant growth in the scientific identity of these youth's ability to deliver climate change messages using that participatory and embodied inquiry activity. And then we also found significant depth in STEM indicators for these youth interpreters. So the youth interpreters really had an effect. Our audiences, we could not measure an effect. So those are two major design issues that we need to address in the future. Then in slide number 15, let me jump into our National Zoo and Aquarium Survey, which we're hoping to release the full report by late March or mid-March, hopefully. It's pretty much done. We're just wrangling about the last few T's to be crossed and I's to be dotted, but it's probably there. Here, I will provide a very quick review of major findings out of that survey, and more on this survey will come out, as I said, in about a month or so. We developed two independent paper-based visitor surveys. Form A basically contained a Six Americas clone of the survey, and I don't know if everybody is familiar with the Six Americas. I believe Ed Maybach is coming to this seminar in about a few weeks. But the luxury that we had here was to actually compare the responses of zoo visitors to the national sample. So this was very, very a unique opportunity for us to do a kind of a treatment and control design with this. And I have to publicly acknowledge the climate communications group at Yale University and George Mason University that allowed us to use the same syntax for their survey analysis. A Form B contained items concerning climate change beliefs, perceptions, and behaviors in zoo visitors, and we administered in the summer to over 7,200 visitors at 15 locations across the U.S. And again, we used the SPSS statistical syntax from the Six Americas study to categorize the visitors into those segments. Let me go over the findings of that survey quickly. Slide number 16 was a major finding is that our audiences are in the red line, zoo audiences, compared to the regular Six Americas national sample for the same year, for 2011. Is that, as you can see, zoo visitors, zoo and aquarium visitors are a lot more receptive to climate change issues than the general American public. As you can see, the top two categories, we have almost 10 points of the alarm and over 20 points in the concern category. And very few dismissive people actually come to zoos, about zoos and aquariums, 6%. And 82% of our sample was in the top three categories. That is significant because in the general American public, those three categories are only the 64% of the general public. So we have a very receptive audience for climate change education. The next slide, number 17, was another major finding is that climate change is perceived as a distant threat geographically. So, for example, 44% agree that it affecting wildlife in Arctic areas. 28% agree that it affects wildlife in their region of the country, and 27% seas that are threats to human health. So climate change is perceived, even by these favorable audiences, as a distant threat, not immediate to them. Slide number 18 is our measurement of how visitors engage in support behaviors. And here we categorize the kinds of behaviors into two major categories. As you can see, consumer behaviors, those are things that people do in their everyday decisions, particularly decisions in the marketplace, and what we call support behaviors, which are more of the general conservation behaviors or activist behaviors that you may see. So, for example, you can see that our visitors really engage a lot more in consumer behaviors than support behaviors, such as, for example, swapping light bulbs, turning down the thermostat, making at least one dinner without meat, or driving a fuel-efficient car, as opposed to donate money to conservation organizations or take political action. So this is a very interesting and important distinction in terms of behaviors in audiences, because environmentalists assume that those support behaviors come naturally, but we're finding that the general public is more likely to do what we describe as consumer behaviors than those support behaviors. Slide number 19, we also see that whether people have a animal or feel that they have animal connections makes a big difference. So this is a complex graph. I'll walk you through it. But the first question on the left is, would you say that you feel a sense of connection with the animals that you see at the zoo and the aquarium? And the answer was yes or no. Then we actually correlated that with whether they feel a connection and what the gap was to those consumer and support behaviors. So you can see, for example, that those people that make a strong connection with the animal have a very small gap between the consumer and the support behaviors, while those animals that have very little connection to animals in zoos and aquariums have a much larger gap between the consumer and the support behavior. So the kinds of outcomes that we try to have from our audiences regarding the kinds of behavior that we expect from them has a very strong correlation with the kinds of connections they have to animals at zoos and aquariums. And that is an important distinction, because that is usually lost in the variability of looking at general samples. In slide number 20, we also found a major significant finding here, is that almost one half of our visitors believe that they have little or no impact on climate change. And as you can see on the thin blue line here, we have the separating kind of the people that feel that they can do something versus the people that can't, they feel that they cannot do something about climate change. And here, this is, I think, is very important, because we're talking about very favorable audiences. Remember, almost 82% of our audiences are in the top three categories of concern about climate change. And still, we're finding that half of these people believe that they have little or no impact on climate change. Probably that is a conclusion of the messages that climate change has been communicating over the last few years, in that we basically tend to say that only large policy decisions, huge lifestyle sacrifices, and international agreements will have a significant impact on climate change. And when you put those things in the context of your everyday consumer behaviors, most people basically tune out or feel that they are very unempowered or powerless to have any effect on climate change. So that, I believe, this graph actually points at a very, very critical need in how we tailor our climate change communications over the next few years. And then when we actually asked our visitors to rank the kinds of barriers that they feel to behaviors in climate change, here the question was, would you like to do more about climate change? If yes, please select among this list of 12 actions that you feel are one of the barriers that affects your decision. And the bottom black line shows that 92% of the respondents selected one barrier. So almost everybody feels that there's some barrier to climate change behaviors. And the top three behaviors or barriers are really significant. The first one is, I don't know what actions would be affected. And that is very relevant, almost 40%, because we have not really expressed clearly to our visitors, our public, what actions and what the effectiveness of those actions are. The second major barrier is that these actions may be too expensive or cost too much money. And the third one, even if I do them, I don't know that they will make a difference. So those three top barriers remain now, or have turned into, the focus of our project, because now into the future, we see one of our major communication challenges to address those three barriers in very favorable audiences, as we have in zoos and aquariums. In slide number 22, we basically enumerate one of the big findings, is that even the most certain and motivated visitors perceive barriers. Barriers are high among our visitors who believe climate change is happening and want to do more to address climate change. The effect of the zoo's experience in climate change behavior is mediated by three main factors. And in this one, I'll mention that we've had, we're actually right now doing a very detailed statistical path analysis of how to distill the main factors that are mediating those barriers. And we found three major factors that are affecting the climate change behavior. The first one is one that we call instrumentality, which is the ability really to be effective about climate change. This is a kind of a bundling factor of barriers that includes the effectiveness, the feeling that actions are expensive, and the feeling that actions may not make a difference. So instrumentality is the ability of people to do effective behaviors about climate change. The second mediating factor in our responses is the concern, whether it's for animals or for human health, but we find that that is a very strong modulating factor in describing future behaviors of our zoo visitors. And the third one is the certainty that climate change is happening. In our case, happily, over 82% of our visitors are certain that climate change is happening. So we have relatively favorable audiences regarding that. So as we plan into the future, these three main factors will be the driving design for us to, the driving force to move us into the design of climate change education interventions, and measure what the effects of these mediating factors are on our outcomes. Sorry, I've been racing through it. If anybody wants any clarification, just let me know. I know I just went very quickly through those graphs. Now I'm just going to present on slide number 23 a summary of our major results of the survey for zoo and aquarium visitors. In no particular order, visitors are very receptive audiences to climate change education. The concern that several zoos and aquariums had about addressing dismissers and doubtful people about climate change should be minimized, because we're talking with very favorable audiences. Never mind, of course, we still get the occasional letter from a radical dismissive, but that should not really affect the way we design our interpretation and education. Communications, because we're talking with very favorable audiences. The second is mostly a barrier, is that or a challenge, is that visitors perceive climate change as a geographically distant threat. So one of our big pushes for the next phase is, how can we explain climate change in the local context? How can we present climate change as a geographically closed issue as opposed to a remote issue in the poles? The third one is another opportunity for us, is that visitors are more likely to engage in consumer behaviors than in environmental support behaviors. So assuming that our visitors are environmental activists is probably wrong, because we're talking with a very large public that sees themselves as modifying their consumer behaviors as opposed to becoming activists. So in a sense, we need to address climate change and climate change behaviors in the consumer realm, the kinds of things that people do in their everyday life decisions, in transportation, consumption, food choices, living choices, and so on.
I have a question with respect to that.
Yes.
You mentioned this a number of times, that there's more focus on the changing consumer behaviors. Do you think that might have an economic cause, like the consumer behaviors might be save them more money or something like that? Or is there another reason that you think that?
Oh, no, yes. There's two sides to the coin. One of them is that it's much easier to make these decisions at the consumer level than at the activist level. I mean, it's
right.
What people do on their everyday life. So highlighting the opportunity to do positive choices in their everyday consumer behaviors is a clear opportunity for us. But, of course, the more we can present those consumer behaviors in the economic context, and particularly within the recession that we're still in, is a very strong driving point. It's not only us, but the Six America survey and all kinds of surveys are showing that the economic downturn has had a significant effect on the way people consume and the way people behave. So the more we can put those in the context, the better, really.
Okay,
yes. Sorry?
No, I just said thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. The next one is we have an opportunity that we suspected existed in the beginning of the design, but now it's being corroborated in our survey, is that we have this unique opportunity to present live animals in very emotional context. So visitors that have a very strong connection with animals are very likely to engage in those desired behaviors, whether consumer or support behaviors. So this is kind of a trump card that zoos and aquariums have that almost nobody else has, with the exception perhaps of national parks and wildlife refuges, is that we have live animals that are in a very strong emotional context, within a very strong social context, mostly the family visit to the zoo, and those sense of connections has very, very strong links to engaging in desired climate change behavior. So we really need to play that card to our advantage as zoos and aquariums. A big challenge is the next one, is almost one half of our visitors believe that they have little or no impact on climate change. So regardless of how much information you give them about climate change, the fact is that most of them don't feel that they can have an impact on the future. That is a huge barrier. It's something that we need to address in terms of design for the future. And the final one is that even the most certain unmotivated behaviors perceive barriers to doing things about climate change. So it is another big challenge, is that even very favorable audiences are facing these barriers. Yes?
A quick question. This is Frank Niepold with NOAA. I very much value the findings and conclusions you're coming to, but in listening to some of the NSF program officers, when these types of conversations come, they I've heard in AGU sessions and things where they're like, this is, you know, maybe not an appropriate role for education and the transition between the conceptual knowledge and action. Have you had conversations with NSF about the, you know, the appropriateness of this? I don't have a problem with this, but I've heard NSF speak these ways, and so I'm just curious to know kind of where the negotiation between the two organizations that you represent in NSF, has that come up yet?
Well, it's come up very clearly. I mean, they actually stated in very bold letters in the solicitation for the implementation phase that they want no projects. They would not accept projects that engage in political activism or directing actions on consumers. So they came out with a non-advocacy clause that is very crystal clear for the phase two implementation phase. So in our case, it is a kind of a very strong line that we need to tackle, because of course NSF doesn't want the project to straddle the activist line. Probably trying to walk a thin line within the political minefield in Washington. So for us, we have to, that has been a kind of a magnifying glass into the design of our phase two implementation phase, because of course, zoos and aquariums are mission-driven organizations. So in our, intrinsically, we're interested in actually changing people's behaviors. How we're going to address that in the design phase is mostly through the presentation of these kind of observational studies instead of directing consumers to specific behaviors. So as I mentioned in the last few slides, our design will be mostly focused about informing decision makers and educators about the choices that people are willing to make. But we are not going to cross the line about telling the public what kinds of behaviors they should take.
This is Jeff Ryan. I just want to echo what he just said, the last sentence he just said, because really, you know, I think the way NSF and my talking to the program officers about this, you can't advocate specific actions, but you can certainly say to people, actions are going to things are happening. You're going to have to make some decisions. Here's the menu of options at your disposal.
That's correct. So, yeah.
Jeff, the menu of options is still on the safe side of that line from the NSF perspective.
I think so. I think you can't properly educate unless you tell people what they're what the kinds of things that might affect what they're seeing are involved, okay? But to say you should, the difference is you're not going to say do one but not the other. You're not going to say this is the way to go.
Exactly.
Part of education is informing people of all the things they can make a decision about.
Yeah, and in fact, in our case, the separation between consumer behaviors and what I would call activist behaviors or support behaviors is really essential, because by opening the choices that consumers can make, really is not about doing one versus the other, but all the possibilities that exist in their realm. So, yeah, but that is a thin line that not only our project, just about every project is going to have to cross, because this is not just a sheer research interest. I mean, we are mission-driven organizations, so we really are interested in fostering change. We'll see. We'll see if we get that grant or not, I tell you. All right. With slide number 24, I'm just going to lay out the working hypothesis for our implementation, and there was some internal debate on whether we should open our cards here, but we're among friends, and I really think that this would help everybody. We found four major working hypotheses. One of them is that youth interpreters really offer very powerful interventions. Much to our surprise, We found that the value of youth, teenagers, talking about climate change crosses several important barriers in climate change communication. It is an intergenerational message. It talks with adults, but it also talks with kids. It's an apolitical. Nobody sits down with a teenager discussing whether they're Republican or Democrat. And the third one is it is in the very appropriate social context of the zoo visit. So nobody, very few people come to the zoo alone, and having the teenager presenting to the social group is really essential. The second working hypothesis is that our strategies should be focused on providing deeper information about climate change, but those general communications are not likely to have significant effects on climate change for all audiences. That means that we really need to tailor the communication strategy to specific audience segments. We cannot expect to measure a significant effect in the general audience if we don't tailor those individual messages to specific segments, which also is related to the third hypothesis here, which is audiences are very diverse and the effects of education interventions are hard to measure due to great variability in response variables. So we are trying to develop a design in which we actually identify a priori the segment that we're talking to and how can we tailor the message to that specific segment. And the fourth one, working hypothesis, that favorable audiences still face significant barriers to climate change and mitigation behaviors, and we need to address that in our design. In slide number 25, I'll present the focus of phase two implementation in terms of specific activities that we're planning to do. One of them is youth interpreters affecting visitor climate change and increasing their self-efficacy. The second intervention would be the social learning circles over several years in which we will use adaptive design with longitudinal interventions to specific zoo visitors that stick with us for over a few years or months on learning about climate change. The third important focus is that we are going to address the two top audience categories, the alarmed and concerned, classified in the Six Americas universe. And it's because we're finding that even though we're talking, and most of us are talking with those categories, we're still facing huge and significant barriers to those categories. So we need to address how those barriers are overcome in the alarm and concern category. And again, we will try to repeat the Zoo and Aquarium survey every 2 years so that we have, now that we've established a baseline, that we can actually monitor any changes that happen at the national scale. So that is the end of my presentation. In the following slide, you have my contact information and our project coordinator, Lisa Ann Kelly, who's also here in the conference call. And I'll just close it at that so that we have a few minutes for discussion and comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's very interesting. I know we've been asking questions along the way, but does anybody have some follow-up questions for Alejandro?
Alejandro, thank you very much. This is Jane Hines Fry in Massachusetts. And I was very interested in the work you did with your youth interpreters. Can you tell us a little bit about how you measured the scientific identity of the youth? And also you mentioned that participating increased their depth in STEM indicators. Can you tell us a little how you measured that?
Yes. Basically, they self-selected among our youth interpreters. We have about 160 youth interpreters in the park every summer, and some of these were second and third year interpreters, so we asked them to self-select and receive training in climate change communications. And then we actually produced an inquiry with guests. So we laid out the youth volunteers in the park in front of the bear exhibit, and they went out with a tablet and pencil and told visitors that they were doing a research on how polar bears choose their habitat in the exhibit. And out of that discussion, we asked the visitors to actually collect information and bring it back to us in a blackboard. And then the discussion at the time when they were putting the data in the blackboard centered around what's happening with polar bears in the Arctic. When we actually hosted these youth interpreters, we did a pre-survey in which we measured a number of indicators about their identities as climate change communicators, which I won't go into a lot of detail. We plan to publish that in the early part of this summer as another one of the project deliverables for NSF, and we hope to release it as a PDF document. But the idea was to use the identity measurements that the National Research Council Informal Science Education report lays out as indicators of identity as science communicators. Things such as, for example, how confident you feel about climate change, whether you dominate the subject, whether are you afraid of talking with visitors about this subject, do you think that you can make a difference, those kinds of things. And in STEM indicators was also about a self-identity of how they feel they are, they can tackle scientific questions, whether they have indicators about if they can actually do a comparative analysis, whether they feel that they have a future as scientists, whether they can have a discussion about a specific comparative inquiry and things like that. So,
did you do this before and after the training?
Yes, yes, of course, okay. Before and after. So before the summer when they started, and even before the training, then we did one right after the training, and then a third one at the end of the summer when they finished their stay here at the park.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other questions? Well, it sounds like you have a number of interesting reports here that will be interesting in and seeing them in the future. Frank, was that you? Do you have another question?
I do. I really valued what you had to say today. It was an excellent presentation. So I'm over at NOAA in the climate office. But the question I have is, I see on your website you have a list of partners, zoos. Can you expand on if you... how you would engage more zoos in your efforts if you get funded?
Well, we might, and in fact, we just tendered an offer to a handful of additional zoos. We right now have 10 zoos in the formal partnership, and we have intentions of bringing in probably 3 more zoos and 1 aquarium into the full partnership. The kind of the push-pull reality of this is that to make this partnership viable, and with having the personal and stakeholder meetings that we plan to have, there's a physical limit to how many we can include. And the idea is that we're working with AZA, the Zoo and Aquarium Association, which is our industry society, society basically, because AZA is looking at how our findings to disseminate through the whole industry. So we still see ourselves as major deliverables of general guidelines for the industry, but at this moment, expanding the partnership beyond 10 zoos has serious physical challenges.
Can you, you may not want to talk about this further, but can if you can, talk about a bit about how you see maybe these different zoos interacting with each other, or are they just going to be using the materials and mechanisms that you're developing through the partnerships and surveys?
Well, which zoos? You mean the partnership zoos or zoos in general?
The partnership zoos.
Oh, the partnership zoos will be very directly involved in the implementation phase because, as I mentioned, we have this adaptive design in which we're going to treat each one of these different treatments or interventions that we have will be treated at different zoos in different times over the next five years. So each one of the zoos is now doing a gap analysis of what kinds of interventions they can do and implement in their park regarding this menu of interventions that we're presenting and in what sequence. And then that will inform how they will engage and how they will collect information regarding those interventions. So there's two ways. Zoos are going to be engaged in implementing these activities through the next 5 years if we get the grant. But then also they will be part of these stakeholder meetings that we will host every year in which we discuss and all the results.
Okay, great. Thanks. Are there any other questions? Go ahead.
This is Chris from Hogle Zoo. I just was wondering, in looking at your demographics of where everyone is from, are any of the new facilities going to be in the Southwest, like Arizona, Utah, where we have political issues with climate change?
No, you may see in our mapping, I believe it's in slide number five, that we have kind of a big hole in the Rocky Mountain Southwest area. We've been actively looking at engaging at least some representative zoos in those areas. We now have Denver Zoo coming into for the Rockies, but in the Southwest we haven't had, we don't have a partner right now. So it's not that we really need to cover everywhere. Those political issues are almost everywhere. Everybody thinks that their region is worse than the others. But yes, we will probably be interested in engaging the Southwest, the Southeast, and the Rocky Mountain area.
Right.
Good. Any other questions? Okay, we're just at 2 o'clock now, so we will close. Thank you very much for this very interesting presentation, and good luck with your moving forward.
Thank you very much, and thanks for this series. It's most interesting. I've attended a number of them, and really looking forward. The next two projects that you have in the conference list are very, very close to us, so we're very interested in hearing those presentations, too.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.